Tom, welcome to the dirt.
Thank you, Jim. Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's just get right into it. Who are you? What do you do? And why should we all lean in?
Well, my name is Tom Shugg. I am the co-founder of a company that you've probably never heard of called Meg Languages. Now, what do we do? Meg Languages helps schools solve all kinds of issues around provision of world language programs. So as you may or may not be aware, finding and retaining a language teacher all across the US, it doesn't matter if you're in downtown New York or in Lusk, Wyoming. I use that as a very real life example, but you cannot find a teacher and you cannot sustain a world languages program, yet world languages are regarded as an increasingly important part of the curriculum. So one way we go about solving this issue is we have a large team of in-country teachers based in China for our Mandarin language program and based in Latin America for our Spanish program. And very simply, we use video conferencing technology that schools are increasingly familiar with. We broadcast our teachers into the classroom for live and interactive language lessons. So we are trying to provide an affordable, like cost-effective solution for languages, but one that really engages students, recognizing that having that context, that real-world context of talking to a native speaker on the ground, is often what motivates students and really like sustains their interest in a language.
That's interesting. What led to this being your mission?
It was the pursuit of the perfect business idea, Jim. A lot of spitballing. The historical context is I moved to China at the tender age of 18. I'd studied a little bit in high school, and I had an opportunity to go over to China. And I mean, I was fascinated with the place. I was fascinated with the language and with the culture. And after about 7 years of living in China, I caught up with a very good friend of mine from elementary school, and we were searching for an idea, something that we could get excited enough about. And we thought, well, there's this fantastic new technology called Skype, and Skype allows the ability for people to have these video conference calls, and they don't always work, but traditionally, having a lesson with a native speaker in your home country, it's quite time. It takes up a lot of time. It costs a lot of money. And the general availability is pretty tough. So we just had this idea of, well, what if we just created a basic platform, a website that allowed individual learners the opportunity to connect with and have these affordable live lessons over Skype. And that was essentially the nucleus of the idea. But we learnt in time that that idea wasn't necessarily going to work.
Yeah, well, I mean, that begs the next question, right? Was like, how did you land on that it wasn't going to work?
Look, we were 27 years old at the time, and we were of the impression that if you create a website and put it on the internet, then it'll go viral and you'll have, you know, millions of customers come at you. And the big concern for me initially was, do we have enough teachers available on the platform? This is before we had any customers. And I had a very sincere conversation with my business partner saying, I think we need an additional 100 teachers waiting in the wings for all of this demand that's inevitably going to occur. And then sure enough, we hit play on the website and just crickets, tumbleweeds, what have you. And we were reminded of our sort of complete naivety as it was in regard to websites. So we got a little bit better. Our marketing efforts got a little bit more concerted, but we were doing everything from a shoestring budget. We were both essentially moonlighting in the beginning. We're still gainfully employed. We're trying to get this proof of concept up and running. But in short, it became too expensive to find the type of customer that we were after. And we were looking for individual learners that wanted to practice their Chinese, in this instance, their Mandarin, be they young professionals or students or enthusiasts. And we would find them in drips and drabs. They would come through the website, But we also found when we did find them that their behavior, their pattern of behavior was similar to a gym mentality where they might have three lessons in the first week when they're really gung-ho about it. They might have one lesson the week after, and then they might not have another lesson for 5 months. And all of signs were pointing to non-viability on this front.
Did they also have a huge spike in January?
To become the new them? They sure did. Yeah, it would have been hand in hand with an actual gym membership and green smoothie subscriptions. And we're definitely in that category. And sure enough, everyone lost interest by late Jan and reminded them of their foibles.
All right, so you make the switch to focus on schools. What were some indicators that let you know you were on the right track, that was your right go-to-market?
So the application we believed in as far as using technology to connect to native speakers, we thought there was still something really special there, evidenced by the fact that one of our team in China might do something simple like take their camera and direct it outside the window in Beijing. And all of a sudden, you're looking at the skyline, you know, the density of living in a big bustling city like Beijing. You might be looking at aspects of pollution. You might be looking at traffic. But all of these things were really intriguing. So we, in a not super organized fashion, just started to approach a number of schools where we were based in Australia at the time with this view to who wants a window into China. You know, we can provide something really interesting contextually and educational that will allow your students to get really excited about a country on the other side of the world. And it was upon throwing a lot of feelers out that we started to get a little bit of interest initially from regional schools, where the story was always the same. It was, we have been advertising for a language teacher. It wasn't always Chinese, but we've been advertising for a language teacher for 3 years. We live in a small community. You know, the butcher speaks German, and the butcher's wife comes in on Wednesdays and talks to the students about what life's like in Germany. But they're not able to have their pick of classic language education. So we had this tiny element of interest, which we explored, and we went out and visited these regional schools, and we were writing the lesson plans, you know, in the car on the way up there. It was all very ad hoc. And when we got in there, we had 25 students sitting on the floor in front of a big screen, and we decided to broadcast one of our teachers in from China, and they delivered this 25 minute lesson. And I would just emphasize that this is going back to 2011, 2012. Video conferencing technology was not what it is today, Jim, as you and I can look at each other in real time and there's not even a glitch. We're talking 2011 Skype. And I say that only in consideration for our blood pressure as we kind of sat up the back of the classroom next to the principal and kind of rode every little glitch and delay there might have been. But like net, it was an amazing experience. The kids were just excited out of their skins over what they'd just done. And there was this perception from the principal that like, this is sustainable. This is innovative. This is exciting. This is something that we want to be a part of. And that, I guess, yeah, gave us the encouragement to approach schools more broadly with a very similar formula.
Did you gather customer feedback or, you know, market feedback in this early iteration that helped inform, you know, that product market fit that you eventually found?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was the number of clients was still so small in the sense that we would visit all of these schools individually. We would get to know the principals. We were talking about, when we're talking about regional areas of Australia as well, Australia, whether you're aware or not, it's a massive country with a very small population. So we would be going to some regional areas where there were no hotels to stay at, and the principals would say, you can just sleep in the classroom here, you know? And we've got some great photos of the early days where, you know, we've got some sleeping mats rolled out in a classroom out in regional Western Australia, surrounded by desert. But these were the schools that we were trying to provide this unique education experience to. So we developed an incredible rapport with these I guess, foundation principals and administrators. And we absorbed as much feedback as we could, and it really allowed us to refine the offering into something more sophisticated and ultimately more scalable, because it's obviously not scalable to need to go and visit and sleep in the classroom of every client that you hope to have in the future.
Yeah, if only, right?
Yeah. If only.
They might, now that you've gotten so big, they might not like that either.
No, I don't think it'd be met with the same, like, two young guys trying to start out. It might just come across right. The wrong way these days. Yeah.
Right. Was there any resistance, whether internal or external, that you guys faced in that pivot towards schools and, you know, towards that kind of being where you guys landed?
There was some resistance. There was some, I guess, bureaucratic resistance. Education departments can be quite sort of parochial institutions, and many of them are not necessarily regarded as innovative vehicles for embracing new models. And we were very much a new model. And I think in the very early stages, there was some concern that maybe we're pushing teachers out of the classroom, which was never the case. Like, we were living in a world where it was using our program was the difference between students having access to a language program or not having access to a language program. There was just simply not enough language teachers to go around. And that continues to be the way throughout Australia, throughout the US, throughout all the geographies that we deal with. But that's not to say that there wasn't some colorful conversations in the early days, particularly as we started to gain some momentum, where there were some departments of education that probably really struggled to, they were grappling with this idea of doing something in a new way. And look, that's, you know, I guess we were disrupting an element of what was considered normal, which is exciting, but also, yeah, required a little bit of resilience at the time as well.
Is there anything that you would do differently as you are working your way through that resistance, now that you're a little more educated on how to push through?
Maybe I would have assembled a board of power brokers that had the kind of suction and influence to maybe put on a braver front. I mean, we presented ourselves, my business partner, Sam, and myself, like we were it. And I think there was a temptation from some organizations to say, look, it's just a couple of young guys. There might have been a dismissive element to that. So maybe, yeah, we needed a bit more gray wisdom to accompany us into some of those heavy meetings with politicians and departments of education. But then again, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it's great that we suffered all that discomfort, and it was probably an excellent development opportunity to kind of wear some of those accusations, you know, right on the face, right on the head. But yeah, for sure, there probably would have been ways in which we could have put ourselves forward in a more robust nature.
Well, obviously you are where you are, which is a pretty great place based on all the little steps along the way. So, you know, easy to look back and do a few things differently, but no, that's terrific progress, man. What you've now expanded into multiple markets. I think you mentioned the US, China, Australia, you know, the list goes on. What were some of the challenges and opportunities you encountered as you started to expand into new markets?
Yeah, look, we were, just by virtue of where we were based in Australia, that was our sort of initial foray into growing the market. And Australia's got a range of time zones as well. And as we started to broaden the application of our product into other states in Australia, the time zones, we realized, actually started to encroach into a lot of other geographies. Early morning in Western Australia actually opened up an early morning block in New Zealand, which actually opened up an early morning block in the UK, which actually opened up a afternoon block in New York. So it was almost, the catalyst for it was also, was almost our operational capacity. And I wouldn't say it happened by accident, but it was just more, we were growing at a rate that we could handle at the time, and we were still refining the quality of the product, and we weren't necessarily in a position to just take on 10,000 schools, you know, in an instant. So as we became aware of these like advantages of the time zone, then we started to approach schools in New York and say, we can offer lessons for this particular window with our team that are based in China. And they were receptive to that. And what we found is, regardless of which markets we were contacting, the issues were always the same. That world languages is a really valid and important part of the curriculum, and we are just incapable of finding and retaining the staff that are going to be able to support us for the long term. So that was, I guess, a surprise in some instances. We would assume that, I use the example of New York, where it's obviously a densely populated metropolis, and you know, one of the most developed cities in the world, yet the same issues were highly prevalent and still are to this day.
So how did you push through all that?
I think it became a matter of we were becoming aware of spreading ourselves too thin, and then it became a matter of going, well, if there's a real opportunity here, be it in the UK or in the US, then we need to invest in it. We need to get people on the ground, and we need people who are going to be available, 24/7, so to speak, to make sure that we can get this program to be taken seriously and obviously service a growing cohort of customers. So that's what we ended up doing. In the US, we brought on one person initially, a country manager, which was essentially required to be a jack of all trades. It was that real startup sort of framework where if something had to be taken to the post office, then that was this person. And if a high level meeting with the district of administrators had to happen, well, that was this person too. And we found a great fit for that role, who's still with us today. And that was a really kind of healthy way to start our foray into other markets, and then eventually build a team around them, which is the kind of the place we're at now.
So we talked about new regional markets. You guys also expanded your offerings from just doing Mandarin to then taking on Spanish. What drove that decision to expand into new languages, and what were some of the things that you encountered as you did so?
Yeah, look, what drove that decision? I think the only thing that should ever drive any decision of this nature, like the market, you know, we heard this directly from the market. The market said, we want Spanish. And the way that that manifested, and again, this was completely contrary to what our assumptions would have been about the market. And I really like this about business, where you have these preconceived notions, but then you find on the ground that you might find something completely different. But we were going to principals all throughout the US saying, we've got this Mandarin offering. It's all we had. It's all we had as far as live in-country teachers. And we just kept getting asked, and what about Spanish, guys? We have a great need for Spanish. And we had these assumptions, like the US obviously has a very large Spanish-speaking population. So we had these assumptions that if you shake a tree in the US, a Spanish teacher would fall out. And that's not the case. That is absolutely not the case. That even in areas of very large proportion of Spanish speakers, having access to actual Spanish language teachers and people that want to be in the classroom as world language teachers is just a really scarce resource. So that surprised us immensely. But like all these things, if you are asked so many times, there comes a point when you're asked something, if you have something for the thousandth time, you're like, well, the onus is on you to actually make it happen. So that's when we did our due diligence, and we headed over to Latin America, and we ended up setting up base in Colombia and recruiting a teaching team based out of Colombia. And that team now is a very similar size to our team in China. And our Spanish program in the US is significantly larger than our Mandarin program, and really makes up for a pretty significant portion of our business. So that's really exciting. And it's been a wonderful journey to apply all of the learnings we had from setting up a team in China to then be able to do it more efficiently, and with all these lessons that we'd learnt along the way, we were able to, I think, do things a lot more seamlessly in Colombia, and it's been a really great fit for our business.
So going forward, whether it's a new language or a new market, how do you look at assessing the risk versus reward of either entering a new market versus expanding the product line?
I think it probably comes down to just some business fundamentals. I mean, we're naturally curious about the market sizing and, you know, the size of any opportunity before we'd look to invest. We do have a experimental sort of mindset where, you know, we are willing to kind of achieve a minimum viable product of something and then test it a little bit, because we understand that it can be hard just on data, currently available data alone, to determine whether or not something is going to work. So there's an element of going with your gut, and then there's an element of understanding that if the product that we're creating is what it says we will be, then this market exists based on the particular market dynamic, and we should be able to sell it. And I think that's the direction where we're going now, as we are starting to add another string to our bow with the development of an LMS platform, a self-paced platform that will be a slight deviation from just our live delivery that's been the core of our business. And that sort of led us to, I guess, having faith in creating something like this, because we are seeing that the market size is actually immense. And we also think that we can bring a lot of innovative aspects to what is it can be a fairly established space, maybe not as much innovation or experimentation going on there as we'd like to think we could bring to the table.
Now, you guys are doing a lot of innovation and experimentation. You even got a new product that hopefully I'm not letting the cat out of the bag by talking about. Can we talk about it?
I think we can talk about it. Yeah, we can okay, talk about it. We spend a lot of time talking about it over at HQ here. So it feels only natural to, yeah, just let a little bit of it leak out at this stage.
All right. Well, let's talk about it.
So, look, I mentioned like this LMS type offering. LMS in itself is not a very exciting term, right? Like LMS is, and you go to a school, say, hey, I've got an LMS. And they say, great, we've got 50 of them already. So, you know, thanks very much. Yeah. Back of the line. But I use that term to just, in a general sense, to just explain what is a platform that we are building that is going to incorporate generative AI. It's going to take students on a learning journey with languages that's going to be able to provide context and those real world checkpoints that we've always thrived on and that we've always felt are really important to the way that somebody learns a language. And as an extension of that, we all know gamification. Again, it sounds like a bit of a buzzword. We all know gamification is immensely important. It's incredibly important for education. And we've been able to move into 3D gaming development, VR game-based development. And it basically started with this concept of, well, is the technology good enough now, or is it affordable enough now? Because there was a perception of technology being, this game development being prohibitively expensive. But is it affordable enough now for us to take students to the Great Wall of China, where they can be in this 3D map of the Great Wall of China, interacting with their colleagues, interacting with our teaching team, as well as exploring what is one of the most significant landmarks in the world? And the answer is yes. And we know that because we've built it. And we've been rolling it out to a number of schools in both Australia and the US. And the feedback has just been electric. I mean, these students are able to be effectively playing a game, but all of the language and learning is immersed within it. And we will be integrating this type of technology within our LMS platform. So again, students will be learning words, learning vocabulary, but then they're going to have a real world application to it in this 3D environment. And nobody else is doing this. And that's what's got us really excited as far as what we can bring to the table here.
How has the gamification trend impacted ed tech just generally from what you've seen on a wider scale?
It's prevalent. That is to say, the lip service around gamification is prevalent. It's something that is cited in all forms of educational academia. It's also something that is applied in a really ugly, inadequate fashion sometimes, not all the time, but a lot of organizations are very keen to trumpet their gamification elements, whereas, you know, shuffling five words around and asking someone to rearrange them isn't adequate gamification from the lens that we look at it through. It is technically gamification, and it is more fun than having the standard sentence. But I think that people can sort of hang their hat on that and go, great, gamified, let's move on. Exactly. But I think gamification in a really exploratory sense is very open-ended, and I think there's just a lot of headroom. We haven't hit the ceiling of what gamification means, especially the languages. And I just, we're obviously in the world languages domain, but I think languages themselves allow themselves to be gamified in a more significant way, just by virtue of the fact that we're learning about another culture, we're learning about another country. And the best part of learning a language is going and visiting that country and being a part of that immersed, lived experience. So that is stuff that can be emulated in a really meaningful way, and especially with the advancements of 3D-based gaming, VR technology, AI, and such.
Do you remember that TV show, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
I just have this picture of, like, the gamification that they used, but the Meg Languages version of, you know, engaging with the audience. Not that you're a one-to-one with Carmen Sandiego, of course. But,
sure.
I just had that visual in my mind.
Well, that's it. And look, I don't know, Jim, if you're familiar with, like, the modern day, like, Zelda games, if you've played Zelda on the Switch recently or anything, but these are just incredible open worlds where you try and you're tasked with, say, getting from point A to point B, but you're halfway to point B, and then you'll get distracted and start picking up mushrooms. Before you know it, you've spent 8 hours picking up different species of mushrooms, and you've forgotten why you're going to point B in the first place. And this is beautiful. This is the experience that we want to replicate with languages, where students are so engrossed in what they're doing that they might deviate from one mission only to be really indulging in another aspect of the learning in another.
I love that. Well, you know, we talked about a hot trend in gamification, and another hot trend is, you know, general kind of AI, machine learning, right? And I know there's this growing trend of automated language learning platforms. How do you see this affecting Meg Languages, if at all? And what's your strategy to stay ahead of the curve?
It's a really great question. Yeah, I'm sure we've all seen similar videos where AI can translate a document with, you know, absurdly accurate way. I think if we look at the way we mitigate it, or I think the way that we would frame a discussion around that is, if translation in itself is an incredibly useful task, it's not the end goal of a world languages program as far as turning students into proficient translators of a language, or even getting them to a proficient level of the language in which they'd be able to go remotely close to doing that. I think the far more significant aspect of a world languages program is creating this global awareness. And there's terminology within the industry of global citizens. And this concept of global citizenship is just to be aware of the world around you, to be aware that we live in this globalized world, and to be aware of other cultures and respectful of other cultures and other languages, and to be participating in a world just beyond your own backyard. So I think that's probably the distinction between what the AI technology can achieve, but there's the real human context that we'll always lean on, as far as let's understand the world around us and appreciate and respect the people from all walks of life around us.
Yeah, I love that philosophy. When you look at evolving educational standards and evolving curricula, how do you handle the challenge of keeping up with these things?
It almost goes the other way. I think the private sector is evolving at a rate of knots that the traditional educational system struggles to keep up with those changes. So if we talk about the cycle of a curriculum, be it the ACTFL or a particular state curriculum, is there will likely be minor adjustments to a curriculum over a decade period of time. But then when you get a model such as ours, maybe with live delivery, that doesn't neatly fit into a pre-existing category of how schools operate or how administrations recognize certain programs, then I think that can probably be, it could be a little bit hard to just conceptually try and fit that square peg into a round hole. To your specific question, adapting what we do to the nuance of particular curriculums or to the demands of particular education institutions is very manageable. It's manageable because, and I'm not making light of it, we've got an excellent team around us and we've got the mental horsepower and the aptitude to be able to tweak our materials in that way that's required. But more broadly, I think the industry, the private sector is moving at a much faster rate than the overly bureaucratic organizations of education. And look, we understand all the reasons why. When you're dealing with thousands and thousands of schools in a particular district, making incremental changes can take a long time. Whereas it's much easier for us small folk to, you know, have our ship pivot on itself and head in a completely opposite direction overnight, right?
Exactly. you and I were talking before the show about, you know, I'm a new dad. You're a dad, right? The similarities in building businesses and building the future in your children, right?
Of course.
And it's not something really on either one. If you're built to be an entrepreneur, that you can throw the towel in on either. Certainly not being a father.
No, that's a life sentence. That one.
That one would be a life sentence. Yeah. What do you see as the similarities of what it takes in building a successful company and being a successful father?
I agree with some of the points that I think you made earlier, Jim, which is everything's new. You've been thrown into we're talking about fatherhood now, in this newborn phase. Everything is new, and you're needing to adapt on the spot to all these new situations that you've never experienced before. So there's managing all of these aspects, and there's managing all these aspects, which on their own sometimes are very, very simple tasks. I'll take the example of changing a diaper, right? That in itself is a simple task. Maybe not the first one, but, you know, by the 100th, you pretty much got it under control. But changing a diaper after 2 hours sleep when you're trying to check your emails and make yourself breakfast in the morning as well, that involves a complexity that, I haven't experienced since like old calculus classes, right? So I think there is this time management and priority management that we can all relate to from starting a business. Plus, there's a grind component. And I know this grind concept is, you know, it's pretty fashionable these days, but this is just good, unsexy, old-fashioned needing to grind through it, where you feel tired and you don't feel like doing things, but you need to make time and you need to make sure that these things get done. And in that way, I think there's a fair bit of overlap between the two tasks.
Yeah, I know that's well put. You know, what has you excited about, you know, going into next year, life, business, father, you know, whatever?
What has me excited? I've got three young kids. They're 5, 3, and 1. So I am just loving seeing them grow and seeing them develop. My my eldest starts school next year. That's obviously a huge milestone, especially in the span of his short life. And that's just, you know, that's a beautiful thing to observe and to see, and that excitement and their relationships grow. I am also very excited about taking my family to the US. We're based here in Melbourne, Australia at present. But the professional excitement is starting to become so overwhelming that we need to go over and experience the US for ourselves. So we're very likely to pack up the whole circus and come up to Nashville in the summer next year, and just get some boots on the ground and have a bit of an explore over there. And I think that's going to be great. And that's going to coincide with the launch of this LMS offering, which we're calling Journeys at this stage. So the launch of Journeys, really spending some time with the team over in the US and merging that with family as well, because I think as an entrepreneur, you know, your first baby, long before you had your first baby, you had your business, and you need to find time in your life for all of your babies. So this is a nice way to kind of merge things together. So 2024 is going to be a ripper.
I look forward to seeing you rip. That's incredible. So at this time in the show, we do what's called the Founder Five, which is just five quick hit questions about you and your growth. First question is, number one metric or KPI that you are relentlessly focused on?
Oh, what a good question. Look, it would have to be, profit and growth. I mean, distinguishing revenue from profit, the adage of revenue's vanity, profit is sanity. Like, we're very aware of that. And particularly when we are investing in new products, we like to be able to measure that they're going to have a certain amount of ROI. So it sounds really boring, but look, we're bootstrapped still. We don't have external investments. So we're just really cognizant of what the money is going to be spent on and what's coming back in, and that revenue increasing does not necessarily equate to success.
Ain't that the truth? next one, top tip for growth stage founders and CEOs like yourself.
Employing the best people that you can get your hands on and paying what is required to obtain them and then retain them. It's just something that we have learnt through experience, and the difference between trying to maybe bring someone who's premature into a role, it's eventually just going to cost you time. You might save some money. We all know time is money, and we all know that the wrong hire is ultimately wasted time and wasted money. So we have just evolved to the point where we want the best person, and when it comes down to what they cost, then it's a matter of, right, we need to find a way to make that work, because we know it's going to be the right solution for us.
Makes sense. All right, next one is a favorite book or podcast that's helped you to grow.
Book. I pivot a lot between. I mean, I love reading business books, like Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. I think is like sort of just a fantastic read about the progression from selling cars in the back of your boot to, you know, to where he is right now is sensational. But I love fiction as well. And another great American writer and personal favorite would be John Steinbeck. East of Eden from John Steinbeck is one of the greats, and I would highly recommend it. But I love to read, and I don't have many rules when it comes to reading. I just like to get my hands in any book and see what I can pull out of it. On the podcast front, the Professor Scott Galloway, Prof G, I'm not sure if you are familiar with him. He is a marketing professor at Stern University, bit of a prolific business person as well. And I've been enjoying his podcast over the past 18 months or so, just great insight into what's happening in the business world, and also, yeah, broader economic things. But he's got a nice family sort of association as well, and the family element is a real priority. And I think back to your earlier point, Jim, like always going to be trying to juggle and make sure that you can enjoy the success you want with your business, but never at the consequence of building really important relationships with your family and being, you know, the most attentive dad that you can be.
All right, next one. A piece of advice that counters traditional wisdom.
Make lots of mistakes. Make lots of mistakes, and because if you're going to fail, you want to fail quickly, and ultimately you will be in a much, much stronger position.
Nice. All right, last one here. What is going to be the title of your autobiography?
The title of my autobiography will be A Work in Progress by Tom Shug.
I love that. That's a good one. Well, Tom, you've given a ton to our listeners today. So I always allow for a little bit of self-promotion here at the end. How can those listening help you out?
Look, you're welcome to check out our social media, what we're doing at Meg Languages. Our at is Meg Global Ed, M-E-G Global Ed. And when it comes to our Journeys platform, if you are involved within a school, if you see any need with world languages, if there's any room for improvement, I would strongly encourage you to check us out, because whatever existing framework you have for languages, I'm sure there's just a little something special we could sprinkle on top there for you.
All right. Thank you, Tom, for joining. This has been an absolute pleasure, man.
Thank you, Jim. I really appreciate your time. This has been fun.
All right. Take care.
You too.